Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. We're short one. We're the OIG Round Triangle because Jason is out. So just the three of us. I'll call it not a round table, but you get the point. So I'm here with two.
3 points.
3 points. It's true. So I've got Matt Kachansky, retired senior executive from the OIG, and then went on to be the Northeast UPIC director and is now a manager on our SIU team. And Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge out of the LA field office and now a member of our SIU investigative team. It's good to see you guys. This week and next week, we're going to talk about staffing for investigative groups, SIU, even OIG. We know, talk about some of the staffing constraints that exist, talk about some of those things. And it's a really good segue, because on next week's OIG Roundtable, we're really going to talk about some of the niche things, and we're going to be talking to one of our clinical auditors who is currently working with Jason on a process improvement team and some of the important needs of having clinical auditors on that team and some of the value add that you get from that. But we want to roll up into that. And, you know, here at Advise, we have been on a hiring spree, which is a good thing. We've been staffing up a number of our contracts. And so I have been spending a lot of time interviewing people for various roles, whether it be investigative roles, clinical roles, data analytic roles, project management roles. It's been busy. But I want to start with you, Wade, because, you know, when we talk about staffing, let's just talk about the importance of having consistency in the interview process. I mean, let's just take it from like the very, you know, kind of bottom end. And that very important part is that consistency. And consistency can be two things. It could be consistency in the questions that are asked during that interview and whether or not there are multi-level interviews or is it just one interview, but then also consistency from the people that are conducting the interviews, right? So let's talk a little about the OIG. Let's forget the issues that involve the current climate and things like what they call direct hire and some of the requirements to get even to the interview at the OIG, because that's a whole different world in the government. So we want to just keep it a little bit more on a level set and not get into some of the nuances of the requirements for different position levels at different pay grades and that. Let's just talk about the process. And so, you know, at the OIG, I know, you know, we had a standard process that worked pretty well, but what are some of the nuances that you saw? And why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because as an ASAC, you were on a lot of those hiring panels, particularly during the boom when OIG was hiring a lot of people, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think we had a pretty good system in LA. We would have like a standard questionnaire with a number of questions, you know, 10 or 15 questions. And we would try and make sure we hit each one of those questions with each candidate. And if they started going off, you know, kind of in the weeds on a certain subject or topic, we would let them do that to hear them out and listen to things. But we wanted to make sure that they all at least had the same kind of opportunity to ask each question so that you could do like a apples to apples comparison. We also had kind of a ranking system where you would, if you thought somebody really hit it out of the park, you might put a 5 by it, or if they kind of bombed, it might be 2 or something like that. But the other part that you mentioned is probably even more important, in my opinion, is you have to have the same panel for all the candidates for a certain position. And I think in LA, we always did. I know, I think I was on one panel as a panelist in headquarters, and I know that wasn't the case. It was like, I talked to other people, and so asked me this question, I'm like, oh, he wasn't even on my panel. So I think that's a real important part of it, because after you do all the interviews, you compare notes, and typically we would interview, you know, dozens, if not, you know, yeah, probably dozens for each position. And you have to be able, again, to compare apples to apples on the questions, but also you have to, like, it doesn't make sense for someone to be voting on, let's bring this person in when they didn't hear 5 of the, you know, 20 interviews. It just doesn't make sense. So that's a real important consistency issue in doing those panels.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the challenge with that is getting, it's like herding cats, right? It's getting the same group of people to be available to do the interview. And obviously each organization is going to make a determination about how many people they want to interview. You know, I know here when I'm interviewing people, if I've got one position, I'm looking at, you know, I think just a few weeks ago, I looked at 350 resumes for a few positions that we're looking to fill. And so the challenge is getting through those resumes and finding the ones that you think on paper will look the best, and then trying to set up those interviews. And then just me by myself doing interviews was sometimes a scheduling challenge. So, you know, I can imagine that. But I want to talk about a little bit, Matt, I want to go to you because the other piece of this is consistency in the questions. And I know, you know, at OIG, we had a bank of questions, and you would pull, you know, kind of the, you know, the way it would work is you'd pull like five or seven questions from that bank and then kind of circulate through them. And I remember doing an interview in New York before I retired, where the person we interviewed had also interviewed in Philly for a position. And so we had to call Philly and ask them by number, what questions did you ask this person? Because we don't want to ask the same questions, obviously, and then have to go back and coordinate it. But to an extent, like in the SIU space, that's less going to be the situation and more in sort of these government things. But let's talk about that, you know, the importance of that consistency and having outside of the same people, like the questions don't necessarily need to be the same, but you've got to have a similar bank so that you're continuing that apples to apples.
Right. Yeah. It's very important that the questions at least cover the same themes, because you want to, and the, you know, the questions have to be carefully constructed by whoever created that bank for the OIG or whoever creates those, the pool of questions for an SIU. You know, those questions have to be carefully crafted to try to get to, you know, what are the actual needs of the position and pull out from that applicant, you know, the information you need to make a good determination. So having those questions, giving everybody, all the applicants, the same opportunity to answer those questions so that you can see the differences between them. You know, everything is subjective, but at least on an objective basis in terms of the, you know, the subject matter, you know, and then you can make these decisions. Not only can you then, you know, probably find the best candidate for you, but in the government especially, protect your process from being appealed by someone saying, I wasn't given the correct opportunity. They found out someone else answered a different question or whatever. Pre-selection comes up, and then that whole rigmarole just, you know, all right. The hiring process comes to a screeching halt.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, one thing that I've noticed here, and, you know, it's an important thing, and I don't want to make this a podcast about writing resumes and things of that sort, but a little bit from the people who are looking to get into the SIU spaces, I constantly get hit on LinkedIn, and even my adjunct teaching, a lot of the students that I'm teaching will ask how to get into the SIU space. And obviously the important thing is read the job description and have a resume that's reflective of that. I mean, I know we had somebody here apply for, not here at Advise, we had somebody apply for a data analyst position, and the requirement was 3 to 5 years of healthcare data analytics, familiarity with billing data, CPT, HCPCS codes. The person applied and they just had none of that experience. And it was a geographical requirement that they lived in a certain area, and they did not even live near that area. They lived like, you know, West Coast, and this was an East Coast position. And, you know, the person was rejected, and they immediately started writing these nasty emails to me about how, you know, they were qualified and we didn't give them a chance. And I literally just felt like I needed to copy and paste portions of the job description and their resume, put it into an email and send them. So that consistency works both ways, like, you know, to be part of that, you know, of that process. But so Wade, I want to go back to you, because as an agent, you develop subject matter expertise. As an ASAC, cases are going to be assigned based upon a level of expertise for people, right? You're not going to give a new agent a multi-defendant case that involves a ton of different potential violations. And then even within your current contract, it's being able to know who to go to, right? And those, so qualifications of people and their background and abilities are sometimes innate, sometimes developed. But let's talk a little bit about, you know, some of those things. And even as basic, and it's not really basic, but something even as basic as, does someone has a particular language skill that you're looking for?
Yeah, that, and we used to kind of tailor our, going back to the OIG just a little bit, we used to tailor our vacancy announcements, you know, there might be a certain project we're working and we need a Vietnamese speaker or a, you know, Tagalog speaker or something like that. So you can kind of tailor the application to try and get those types of those applicants. And I've run into that a little bit too with the SIU portion of it, where there's a language issue, and it's even harder when it's like a remote situation because you're trying to do interviews and it might be a certain group that it's where most of them English is their second language, and it's so or they don't speak English at all. So now you're trying to do interviews through a translation service on the phone, and it just doesn't work. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Like, it might be you get a pool of applicants, and it might be the thing that puts one to the top is if they have a certain language skill. And same thing with the demographics. You know, a lot of these jobs, people are working from, you know, thousands of miles away, which is fine in most cases because most of it is computer work. You know, it's data analytics type of thing. But if you need to do like an on-site or a drive-by or something, and nobody lives within hundreds of miles. So if you're hiring, that might be another area to look. It's like, it would be good to have somebody in the state of, you know, whatever the state is you're hiring for, and not have everybody throughout the country. So those are a couple things to kind of look at. And I think I skirted your question altogether. What was your question again?
That's pretty much it. Yeah, I mean, you bring up a couple of good points, and the one of them is demographics. And when we talk about demographics, we're talking about regional demographics. Like, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if I was on Staten Island with Jason Eisengrein doing interviews, he was from Staten Island, right? It was local. And, you know, Jason says it all the time, all fraud's local. But there is something to be said about going to an area where you're familiar with the area, you're from the neighborhood, you can kind of, you know, deal with it a little bit better. And, you know, really the nail on the head for me is when you're talking about people with certain language skills, you know, it really becomes invaluable to have somebody who can just help you with that interview and it not be on the phone remotely. Translation services are an important integral part of it, but, you know, there's nothing that beats it. And I know in New York, you know, we started doing a hiring where if you spoke Russian, you were definitely getting to the top of the pile among your other qualifications because of that large population of Russians in the initial strike force, right? We had Puerto Rico was in the New York region, and we had people that went down there who didn't speak Spanish, and they did not, you know, they had a hard time. They couldn't do their job. In order for them to do their job, somebody who spoke Spanish had to go with them. So yeah, that's a great you know, those are just innate qualifications that people develop. But Matt, so I want to go to you because I want to talk about like specific qualifications that people go and get, right? So some people go and become a CPC, or they become an AFI, accredited healthcare fraud investigator, or like I have a CFE, certified fraud examiner. And, you know, not to knock any of these certifications, but in the early days of AFI, you can get grandfathered in. In the early days of CFE, you got grandfathered in based upon experience. Now, right, there's a process, there's testing, there's, you know, credits that you have to get. The CPC can be a challenging exam for people that have never worked in the space. But let's talk about like those qualifications, or we'll call it those value adds, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, you always look for general qualities of people, you know, natural curiosity, you know, willingness to go the extra mile, attention to detail, all of those things. But then, you know, you've got to see that those things are demonstrated. And some of the ways you can do that is, what is their work experience? And then what have they done to become experts in their field? Have they gone and gotten these qualifications? Have they kept them up? Have they continued the education? Have they provided training, you know, based on those qualifications? So you look for those things because they do add a lot to the job. For example, a CPC, you know, for us or for any SIU is an incredible complement to the person's skills because they can do so many things. You know, if you have a nurse that's an RN and a CPC, they bring both clinical skill and experience as well as coding. And that helps on any aspect of the investigation beyond even the medical reviews that are done. So they're very important to see those things, but you got to make sure that, you know, their experience is kind of in line with them and they just didn't go out and get it. And it's just kind of sitting there, you know, just moot to what they've been doing. So very right. important that you see those types of certifications. I think right. on some of the SIU jobs, you'll see that having a CFE is a mandatory qualification.
Yeah, and I'll tell you that what we're starting to see are more and more SIUs sending their staff to CPC boot camps to get them either to pass the CPC exam or just to get them that requisite knowledge and experience in doing it. You know, we've done that for a number of our SIU clients. We did on-sites for SIU. Some of the SIUs, there's one in particular that we worked with where they wrote into their policy that within 12 months of being hired, you must have a CPC. I've seen other job postings where the CPC, CFE, something similar is encouraged. And in other instances, I've seen where, you know, upon hiring, you've got to enroll in the course and take it. So, yeah, I think those certifications tend to lend themselves. I don't know if a certification like a CFE or an AFE lends itself to a greater level of skill. But what it does demonstrate is the commitment to inquisitiveness, right? Yep. That you're constantly, because you have to continue to take those courses and what have you. I don't know if becoming a CFE enhanced my ability to be a better investigator or just continued my path on the inquisitiveness, right? To look at things. And so, you know, Wade, I want to give you the last kind of say on this, but you know, when you're talking, you know, about these specialties and kind of these niches outside of someone with potentially a language ability because of a geographic area, having someone who's got some requisite knowledge of a particular specialty can also go just a huge way, right? For someone's ability to be able to investigate things faster, just understand it, just someone to kind of bounce ideas off of. That's that level of skill is super valuable.
Yeah, and I think it's important, and I'm sure you'll agree with this after doing all the interviews you've been doing, but to have a good variety of like backgrounds on an SIU is important. You might have some, like, I don't think you can have all retired OIG guys or all retired cops or all people that came from another SIU. I think having that good mix, because they all bring different backgrounds, I think it's very important to have people who worked at, you know, either one of the carriers, the UPICs, the ZPICs, going back and forth, because they might have more knowledge on policy and Medicare manual type familiarity, more so than an agent would have, or for sure more than, like, sometimes we hire retired police officers, that would be an area that they're not familiar with. But also having somebody, you know, if you have somebody who's got a, you know, chiropractic background or some kind of, they were in the field, nurses are probably the best example, somebody with a nursing background, they just have so much knowledge that you could tap into. And then if the SIU team is working efficiently, if they come up with an issue that's maybe a policy issue, they should go to the person who worked for the ZPIC that maybe has the best background knowledge on that. If it's a clinical issue, they should go to the CPC or the nurse, you know, somebody who's a nurse practitioner. But to have those various backgrounds and being able to tap into all those, I think is pretty crucial in getting a efficient, you know, SIU unit.
Yeah, we had a physical therapist on our staff at the UPIC, and she was incredible.
Right. Yeah, having some people who have that requisite expertise, like, you know, someone who's a chiropractor or a physical therapist or someone, you know, in that clinical space has really got a great value. You know, the one thing you said, and I guess we'll close with this, is it shouldn't all be OIG guys and it shouldn't all be non-OIG guys. You need that mix, like, you know, and you see it, right? So, you know, you coming with that law enforcement background, it's all about getting the bad guys. And if you've come strictly from an SIU background, it's about getting all of the money. And so having that mix, it lets you, with the law enforcement background, understand the SIU mindset a little bit better, but it also lets the SIU people have a better mindset. You know, we talked about that I did a presentation at the NHCA, and we talked about this ongoing sharing that maybe the SIUs need to provide training to law enforcement instead of it always being the other way around, right? Understanding each other's processes, you know, would go a long way. So look, we're going to have this discussion is going to continue next week. We're going to talk with one of the nurses that's currently on our team, Lara Champagne. She is been in this space for a very long time on the clinical side, on the process improvement side, on the operational side. She's forgotten more than some people know. She's currently on a very large process improvement, an SIU rebuilding project with one of our clients. And, you know, she's going to come and talk a lot about the importance of having people embedded in the SIU with certain skill sets. So we're going to carry that conversation on next week. So as always, it's great seeing and hanging with you guys, getting your individual perspectives. Again, to the people that watch and listen to our podcast, thanks very much for participating by listening and downloading. Again, you can get the podcast every week in our newsletter, hello@advisehealth.com. And you can also get our previous podcast on our YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube, look for Advise Health, hit that subscribe button, and you'll get it as they come out. So as always, good seeing you guys, and we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.
Thank you all.
Thank you.